Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 25. Today is December the 1st, 2014. This week we will be discussing what permaculture is and examples of this form of sustainable living. I am joined by Kirk Pattis, Eric Taylor, Chelsea Como, Danny Ning, Lydia Tabbitt, and I am Matt Winterer. And we're going to hand it off right away in the beginning to Kirk Pattis.
So, this permaculture thing, I stumbled upon it accidentally. I was researching some sovereignty books and some of the top books to read on a website. And then down in the comments section, permaculture kept popping up. People kept recommending any books on permaculture. So when I looked into that, it just really resounded within me about I've always had this desire to know how things work, and I've always had a problem with how our agriculture system works, and permaculture is just a way of life that ties in all facets of the environment and utilizes nature to the most completeness that I've ever come across in agriculture sense. And it's just a very interesting way of life, and I find it very interesting. What are you guys for? I know no one really knew about this when I brought it up a week ago, and what do you guys find interesting about it?
Well, I mean, as we start to go along and get farther and farther into our current systems, we can see that, you know, we keep hearing about sustainability and whether or not what we're doing is sustainable. And we can see that we likely can't continue operating the way that we're currently operating without negatively or adversely affecting the future. So it's interesting to me to kind of really re-examine how we're doing things and how we're operating to see if we can do things better, if we can improve upon systems or change systems so that we're doing the most good, using the least amount of resources while still making sure that we're meeting all of our needs. And some things seem fairly obvious, but some things we don't really take into consideration just because the technology that we have today allows us, you know, different options that weren't necessarily available 100 years ago. So it's interesting to see how we can kind of leverage new technology with, you know, some age-old traditions of, you know, biodiversity and things of that nature. So it's almost like combining the old world and the new world.
Yes, exactly. It's, to me, this is the pinnacle of technological advancement in agriculture, which is really utilizing, well, it's through the study of land and all the facets behind it and tying it all together in economical and just for how plants grow, that it conserves and utilizes every option. There's no waste in the system, and it's just the most efficient way of harvesting plants that I've come across, and the most diverse. I mean, it's you're taking a piece of land and utilizing it in the best way to control the runoff of water and capture that, and how through the way we, all right, well, farmland today is really becoming it's forming this desertification to where the only reason plants grow is because of the fertilizers that we dump on these plots of land, that the soils have been depleted from the growth of the plants, and then from the pesticides and weed killers that we throw on the ground, it kills off all the microorganisms that really that plants grow naturally on. So it's our farmlands today are purely artificial lands that look natural when you first look at it, but really they're just it's a form of technology that we came up with, you know, about 100 years ago to deal with the problems of stripping the land of the nutrients. And the Dust Bowl happened, and then so we figured out, we'll just start adding fertilizers, and then those create problems, so we add the pesticides because the plants, the bugs come in, and then weeds start to grow in between, so we dump the weed killers. And for how plants grow naturally, they're hardy, they naturally defend against bugs, and then as we continually grow on these plots of land that the nutrients are stripped, the cells of these plants aren't as strong, and the bugs then purposely they go after, then they really want these plants. So, and that's what created the problems of why it had to keep progressing more and more chemically. And we're just at a point today with GMOs, and that it's really just there to for these plants to be able to feed off these chemicals that we have to put to it. And I do not see this sustainable at all. And so this permaculture stuff is exciting new development. And it's really, yeah, exactly. It's going back to the old with current research and the information that we have today that is only going to make it stronger and stronger. And it's very self-sustaining and profitable is what I gathered for a lot of people.
Well, I mean, I get that, you know, not a big fan of the commercial farming and commercial agriculture, but there are some, you know, concepts in there that they are employing that are along the lines of permaculture in terms of like rotating, because you mentioned the Dust Bowl, and one of the major things that changed after that was really a permaculture idea, even though the term permaculture didn't come around for many decades afterwards. But just like crop rotation, you know, that's something to keep in mind. And that's something that's a sustainable practice that makes a big difference when it comes to, you know, farming and growing things and keeping the soil in consideration. But I wouldn't say that, you know, commercial farms haven't completely, you know, that they've completely ignored all of those things, you know. But I don't think that even if we didn't have, you know, those types of things to consider, part of it is also, you know, energy and water conservation. So it's not just about food. It's also about, you know, energy and getting everything that we need and even conserving, like, the heat in our homes and making sure that we're, you know, arranging them in a certain way on our land, if we're buying a plot of land and then choosing to build a house, and then taking into consideration the slope of the hill and how that's going to have an effect on heating, and even going so far to say, depending on, you know, what kind of a slope you have where you're going to plant your house, you're going to think about whether there's a fire hazard associated with that, because a fire will go very quickly uphill. And then, like, placing, you know, a pond, that will help, you know, kind of naturally, you know, provide a barrier for a fire, but then also will help, you know, provide some heat for your home as the water heats up. And then that will, I don't know exactly how to describe it well, but having a pond near your home can actually help keep it warmer as well. So just taking into consideration all of these different things that you can place in and around your home to conserve energy, to conserve water, and increase your food output and the quality of your food. Do we have a clip that really starts to go into, like, how the mechanics of it all and what permaculture is?
That sounds great.
Yeah, we have a clip. I can play a clip here.
Hi, I'm Michael Pilarski, and I'm here to give a plug for permaculture. What is permaculture? It's the design of sustainable human habitats. It's the design of a world that gets richer and richer in terms of biomass, life, biodiversity, healthy forests, rivers, waters, etc. And why should you be concerned about permaculture? Because every human on Earth is drawing on the Earth's resources, and we all have to give back in some way. Everybody owes a debt, so to speak. And so we all have to do something to help the Earth. And one way to do that is to reduce your dependency on outside inputs that come from around the globe and take a lot of energy. So the more you can grow your own food, build your own houses, create your own medicines, take care of your own needs, the less of a draw you are on the Earth. So that.
So is that one of the, Kirk, was that one of the biggest positives that you found around permaculture when you're researching?
Be more specific about what?
Well, specifically what was talked about in the first minute of this clip.
Well, what I like the most is the ethics and the principles behind it. So,
specifically, what ethics and like what principles? Like which.
Can we just get into that later?
Sure. I'll continue playing.
That's one of the reasons that you learn permaculture, so that you can become more productive. The other reason that you learn permaculture is because it teaches you skills to how to give back, how to plant trees in a good design, how to take care of the environment, how to repair ecosystems, how to help produce healthy ecologies where you live. So permaculture is a way of learning how to give back to the Earth. And if you become good at permaculture, you will become more productive in a more well-rounded way. You will require less dependence on outside inputs, and so you'll be less vulnerable. We live in a time of great centralization of power, and economies and governments. The scales are really big, and the possibilities of problems are increased as the system becomes more complex. So it's really good to learn how to do simple things that will produce the things you need close by using local resources. And so that's, permaculture is really good at this. I'd like to promote a couple of books at this point. And I don't have them to hold up in front of you, but one is a book called Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land by Gary Paul Nabhan. Just came out this year, 2013. Brand new book, hot off the presses. And his thesis in this book is, how do we grow food in a changing climate where the climate extremes are higher? And in particular, how do we do it in the arid and semi-arid so-called desert regions of the world? Now, Gary lives in Arizona and New Mexico and works a lot in northern Mexico as well. So, but he's traveled around the world to some of the driest parts of the world and see how people can produce food when things are really hot. And a lot of the world is getting hotter and drier, and so this is a very useful book for people that live in those areas. But it's a template for a book on how do you produce food in any particular climate when the climates are becoming more extreme. Permaculture helps you design systems no matter which way the weathers or climates change. You become more adaptable, your systems become more adaptable, your plantings become more adaptable because you're, in a sense, hedging your bets. So this is a good book, and Gary talks a lot about permaculture in it. Another book, somewhat along these lines, is a bit older. It's a book called Gardening When It Counts, or Growing Food in Hard Times, by a man named Steve Solomon. Now, this is probably a 12-year-old book. It's been a while. But he saw the handwriting on the wall a long time ago and left the U.S. and moved to Tasmania. And his thesis in this book is that it's going to become more important that people grow their own food. And how do we do it with low inputs in a local system way? And so his book is really good on what hand tools do you need, how can you grow a gardens without using watering systems, even in pretty dry areas? And how can you do it yourself? Now, Steve is not so much a fan of permaculture. In fact, he actually, you might say, pokes holes at, or pokes at permaculture. But we use his work, or I use his work nonetheless. I draw on the learning and the knowledge and the skills of people in many, many disciplines. And so permaculture draw is an interdisciplinary. So I can work on, pull things from Steve Solomon, from Gary Paul Nabhan, or from hundreds and thousands of other authors. So permaculture is a well-rounded way of learning how to exist in a changing climate, in a changing social systems, and in changing economic systems, and coming out looking good. Because it's good to hedge your bets. And if you're hedging your bets, permaculture is probably one of the best investments you can make.
One thing that I think is kind of interesting about the whole permaculture thing is that it focuses on localization and being self-reliant, or, you know, locally reliant as opposed to globally reliant. And one of the things that I was looking at that I thought was interesting was not just thinking about this in terms of food and gardens, but all of the products and resources that we use on a daily basis, and focusing more on what can you get that nearby as opposed to far across the world from you. So either producing it yourself or getting it from the local market, which I think is interesting. And instead of this globalization thing, it's more of a localization movement. And it's focusing on smaller communities and self-reliance, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah, I definitely think it ties into with liberty aspects in that way. Of sustainability and localized vicinities and dealing with, you know, communities in a way where the stronger your neighbors are, they're more self-reliant, I think that creates a stronger community. And you know, then any excess food or products that you produce you can sell. And then since we all need shelter and food to live and water, and you're taking care of that yourself, then you're free to actually go and pursue your life's interests and not have to actually worry about how much money you're making either, because your bare necessities are taken care of. But
how realistic is it for us to provide for all of the food that we're going to need or all of the water that we'll need to survive? I mean, especially in more extreme climates like in Minnesota here, how do we, you know, every single one of us, is it really realistic for us to say that we could grow all the food we'll need all winter long, or grow all the food we'll need in the summer and then have enough space and area to be able to store it throughout the winter? I mean, I don't know how realistic it would be to say that we could have all of our food and all of our water needs being met as individuals.
Well, I think a lot of people do that, and it doesn't take that many, it takes knowledge and work though and I wouldn't say recommend anyone to just jump in and do that. It'd be a learning curve for sure. I think 1 acre of grain of like wheat growing would sustain a family for 3 years, just 1 acre of wheat.
But if they just ate wheat for 3 years, I mean,
well, it would just be enough wheat.
Let's be like realistic.
Well, yeah, well, that's what I'm saying, but that's just the wheat aspect. So you'd have to, but at 3 years, you won't even need a full acre of wheat either. But it's all on how
a lot of people don't have an acre though.
Well, that's what it goes in the communities too, that if you work with your neighbors, say, I'll produce this, if you're going to produce that, and we can trade, barter that way. It's something that would have to develop on its own.
You know, like would people kind of go back to the older tradition of canning their food for the winter?
Well, you'd have to, of course. It's not an older tradition. People do that still today all the time.
My mom does it, but it's kind of a...
I don't know, buddy. I haven't...
do that.
I haven't gotten out the old canning supplies in a few years myself.
If I had the storage, I would can every year. Because how much better is it to eat fresh fruits and vegetables when they're at their peak? And that's, you can it at that time because you want to preserve that freshness at that moment and be able to utilize that throughout the year then. So that's where it goes timing and
my mom can, you
know? Yeah.
But I mean, a lot of people, like you said, don't have the storage for it.
Or the land to do this. So but if you
have the land to produce it or the area to storage, you know, so part of it is a space and ownership issue. I mean, if people are living in an apartment building, you know, and there's, you know, let's say 100 tenants in that building, there's not 100 acres of land surrounding that building for them to then farm and grow food.
Well, it wouldn't require that much either. But
you know, their apartments aren't going to have the, you know, storage capacity.
Well, I'm not saying this can replace everything. I'm just saying this is for localized people that are interested in it. And it's...
Well, I'm just saying... Like,
but even just in a even in a downtown setting that you have a front yard that's, you can convert your front yard into a garden that would, you could probably grow all the vegetables and fruit that you'd need for the year in a small garden. It doesn't,
downtown, that's probably not true. Because downtown, you're sharing your like front yard with, you know, hundreds of other people.
Well, it's all relative. This is not a blanket statement that will cover everyone by no means.
All right.
You
can do a lot with a little land.
I mean, but at the same time, like, I know in terms of, like, I look at the amount of output from, like, the gardens I've had, and, you know, and you put in the work all summer long, and, you know, and then you reap the bounty of that, you know, you take all the vegetables and fruit out of there. And I wouldn't even say that much food would have sustained me for a month. And it's not like I had a huge garden, but it was as much room as I had to be able to grow food.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, you would reverse engineer. You'd say, all right, I have a family of X. We would need this much, and then you can go to plants, and, you know, they produce about this much on average. So that's you'd have to determine how many plants you'd have to grow for the year.
It takes planning, but it also requires space. And I think that's where I'm really pushing up against this and saying a lot of people don't have enough space to be able to grow all of their food.
Well, that's because of how our culture has developed. Our culture has developed into this. We don't need land space, or people don't even want it because it takes maintenance. And so we've been forced into this, you know, or houses are stacked right next to each other. This is all we've because we're so used to the farming agriculture system that we have, that this is the result from it. And it's becoming more and more unsustainable because of it. And it creates this more centralized pollution and more systems that we need to rely on for city governance to remove our waste, produce our water. And so that's just the effect. So if for striving towards a liberty and more of a sovereign, sustainable future, that if this starts taking off more and more, like it seems like it is, you know, people will want that start wanting that extra land space and, you know, getting away from these townhomes or condominiums or, you know, or the such. Or else maybe cities, you know, they'll have to start lobbying. I know Chanhassen has a community garden that, you know, residents can go and plant their own stuff in this garden that's, I don't know exactly how it works. I just know it exists. I've never gone and looked into it. But, you know, so cities can produce, you know, section off so many acreage or something that people could rent, you know, the land to produce their plants. And, but that's, that's not even close to a permaculture system. That's more just a general plot of land that's tilled. But
so then, I mean, I can certainly see how there's just a ton of room for us to employ more of these methods and take advantage of and use more wisely the land around us. I think that, like you said, the way that we're currently living and the way that, you know, our homes are arranged and the spaces that we're using, we aren't necessarily set up to be able to do this, you know, for everyone to be able to do this. There are some people that have the luxury of land and space that can employ a lot of this more. But as it currently sits, you know, if you've got a couple hundred people living in, you know, apartment buildings right next to each other in the city, it's not as reasonable. But maybe instead of just having, you know, maybe putting a rooftop garden or having things like that where you're utilizing as much spaces as possible.
Yeah, that really wouldn't be permaculture, but I would encourage that anyways. But, you know, all five of us agree to disagree. All right, that's fine. But, well, all five of us live around the city. I mean, if all five of us lived out just a half an hour outside the city, we all have different viewpoints. We all have plenty of land. So it depends.
I live on an acre, dude. I think I could probably make plenty of food here.
I totally agree, but the vast majority of the populations around the bubble of a city don't have that much yard to deal with, or the desire to go out there and do something like this. And I just hope it's a growing culture. But I'm saying if all five of us grew up on a farm, you know, we'd have a different outlook on space available and how to utilize it. So there's plenty of people throughout this nation and the world that have plenty of opportunities to utilize their land in a permaculture setting. But
right,
so
I'm not saying that nobody can. I'm saying that only the people with space can. So I think we're in agreement there. You know, if you live in the country and you have many acres, absolutely, you've got a hell of a lot more opportunity to take advantage of that.
I think it's great if people do.
Absolutely.
It would be awesome to just move to another country and set up permaculture, or just move buy a plot of land on the farm in that country and shape the land to the permaculture principles. But everything is a system. Let's look at politics. So a government is a system. So, you know, all communism, democracy, republic, socialism, that's all a specific aspect, a code of ethics, per se, or philosophy towards that system. So if we take, you know, and so it can work in areas and it cannot. And so to me, you know, how can you take an ex-communist country and make it into a democracy country right away? It's something that's tough to do, but it takes years of process to start. So it's the same sense in permaculture. So farming's a system.
That's a great point.
It depends from one to another. Yeah. So it's a mental shift. It's a ethical shift, based on, you know, philosophy, principles, and the techniques employed. So it's something that you can't just jump into. It's, you know, and that's just my favorite part about it is it takes a system it's taken a system of life and it's fine tuned it to, utilize all the waste and actually through food and plants, you know, that's nature's recycling mechanism is, you know, that's what nature does. It takes waste. So many different varieties of plants and yeah. So it's, that's just my favorite part about it. It's a form of an engineered life that's just taken the knowledge of history and refined it to, utilize the land and the landscape to its full potential. And we have machines that can even shape land today to make it even more viable. If the plot of land that you have isn't completely suitable yet, you can do small changes or large changes to, create massive things. And you can, like what the guy was talking about earlier, you can, take deserts and rehabitate the land, repair the land into making it fertile ground. And to me, that's just awesome. To where this one clip, actually, I think we're going to play this clip, that one TED Talk where he's talking about how the Middle East is a prime area for stuff like this. The middle, like, look at the Nile throughout history, that the reason the Nile was so fertile is because the Nile flooded every year and it flooded miles into inland, and then it receded and it left all that silt and left fertile ground to grow crops on every year. So should we just play that clip about that TED Talk one?
Well, maybe... I have a question before we go into that clip. So we talked about permaculture, and I have a quote from Bill Mollison, who's the he looks to be the kind of the modern day inventor of permaculture, and he says permaculture is a philosophy of working with rather than against nature, of protracted and thoughtful observation rather than protracted and thoughtless labor, and of looking at plants and animals and all their functions rather than treating any area as a single product system. But when I hear that, when I've heard what you've been talking about, I don't really know what permaculture means. I mean,
it's a trademark name.
What does it actually mean? I mean, you're gardening, you're harvesting produce, et cetera, but what does that mean?
Well, to me, if you take perma, it seems like it's short for permanent, and culture is just the way of living. So it's creating a sustainable way of life to exist on life. And to me, that's one of the ultimate things to strive for, in my opinion, for not destroying our land around us, but actually reaping the benefits from it and creating a system that's self-sustaining and beneficial for generations to come. Go ahead, Lydia.
Permaculture comes from the combination of the words permanent and agriculture, expanded to stand for also permanent culture. But I think originally a combination of permanent agriculture.
Makes sense.
So, like, specifically, I think the thing that makes this a different, so if we're going to say, we can talk, you know, on a high level, yes, permanent culture, but what does that really mean in terms of how we act or what we do? And part of that is looking at the natural systems that are already in place in nature. And instead of just saying, well, I want something like this. You know, I want to build my house on top of a hill, or I want to, you know, live here, put my garden there because that's where it's aesthetically pleasing. Instead, it's taking those understanding the way that nature works and using that to our advantage. So, for example, if you, in order to use your water more efficiently, I don't know if you guys have heard the term gray water before.
Yep.
I haven't.
Yep.
I'm not.
Okay. So gray water is, so the water that goes down your drain when you take a shower, for example, reusing that water, would be gray water. So, one of the things in permaculture would be to say using that gray water to then, distribute over like the plants in your garden. Or, and another way to do that, you can take the water from your house and then put it through like a pond with reeds in it that will serve as a natural filtration device. So like there are certain types of, you know, plants out there and different natural systems that filter water. So you can, you know, divert your, you know, secondhand water through a natural filtration system and then reuse the water to maybe water your garden or lawn around you. So employing different methods like that instead of just the traditional, you know, you take a shower, it goes down the drain and it's gone. You use it once and that's it. You know, so repurposing, reusing, and then using the natural processes that are already in place in nature instead of going against, you know, what nature would have it.
Yeah, well, that's actually a part of civil engineering. That's how to treat a lot of just waste in general is through nature that way, too. So that's what even a business could utilize something like that has certain type of waste that they can put into a pond and have nature clarify it through that those means as well. And that's why I just love that that you know about that now, that people are coming to an understanding that nature is actually a filter of waste. And that's why a few weeks ago when I talked about how, you know, all businesses, you know, really should deal with their own waste. They shouldn't pump it into other people's property and or have just society have to deal with it in general. That there's means and methods to almost, you know, reduce any kind of waste into back into a natural setting. But it's not strived of as a system. And that's why
there is some, I forget exactly what the term is for it, but where they have these farms inside the ocean where essentially there'll be like a huge net and then they'll farm fish in there. And then they'll have essentially like, they'll create its own sort of like ecosystem. So they'll be raising the fish like tilapia or something. But then you have a concentrated amount of tilapia, they're going to produce waste. So then they put algae, they plant algae in there, which serves to filter it. And then they also put shellfish and grow shellfish in that area, which also serve to filter the waste from the fish. So you're growing fish with, in water. So it's
in the ocean,
you're not using, land space. And then you're also not producing waste because you're putting in these natural filtration systems in, like shellfish or, I forget the type of, like seaweed, so that it's naturally, making sure that you're not polluting the water around it, even though you are farming, in the ocean, you're not producing waste around it.
Yeah. Well, you're concentrating the waste by having such a large amount of fish in one vicinity. And so you're producing all that waste, which can pollute the general area, which can cause problems. But yeah, by putting other, organisms in place that would filter it to help clean it up to not have such a environmental impact to that area that you're growing fish, which naturally wouldn't maybe produce that many in that one vicinity since you're having a cage around it or such.
Well, and it sounds like the reason that, or one of the main reasons why it's traditionally been the diet in a lot of Asiatic areas is the whole rice and fish diet, and seaweed, is because that's a sustainable little ecosystem. You can have a pond with fish and seaweed and rice, and they will all grow together without, tainting or harming each one. They're all very beneficial to one another because the fish, I mean, you have to feed the fish. I forget exactly what they would be eating. But then their waste then serves to provide certain types of nutrients so that, the rice and everything can grow. And then the water gets filtered through, like, having the seaweed in there. And so this was sort of, many, many, many generations old, or centuries old, I should say, permaculture little plot. And that's kind of where the whole rice, seaweed, fish diet came from, was because people looked to the natural systems and found that these things worked very well together. And that it was a symbiotic relationship to have the fish and the rice and the seaweed. And so that's why they farmed it that way.
Hmm. Should we play that clip for a little bit?
The X Talk?
Yeah.
The TED X Talk clip.
Or we could just go into that ethics one too, but...
It's your call, Kirk. Which one do you want?
Let's do the TED Talks. Let's just start for a little bit, and then we can stop it soon.
All right.
I'm an international permaculture designer and teacher. My teacher and mentor is Bill Mollison, the founder of permaculture. Permaculture is a movement that now works everywhere in the world, in every single country. And it's connected on the internet. We have a worldwide permaculture network. Permaculture's a system that was founded because of the evidence that there are so many problems in our world that have been created because of the resources that have been required to supply the needs of humanity. And rather than defining the or protesting the problems, permaculture defines the solutions and directs positive action. It's an ethical design system. It's a system that takes the knowledge of nature, the knowledge of natural systems, and uses the connectivity of the elements to create a system that provides the needs of humanity in a way that endlessly enriches the life on Earth and the living systems. It uses ecosystem modeling, where ecosystems and their connections between elements and principles continuously stabilize and enrich and develop systems that increase diversity.
Just a little bit of a show note here. The comments on this clip are that it's quite slow. So, I'll play.
Well, I think we can cut it off. I think we should. What do you guys think? This would promote liberty in the world, or do you think this is just something that, you know, people will do if they want, and you know that's fine. But, or do you think this is a growing movement? You know,
it sounds like a bunch of hippies standing around banging bongo drums and smoking weed.
Well, I mean. What it comes to liberty, the cool thing about it is that when you talk about self-reliance and decentralization, I think that those things naturally lead to an increase in liberty. You know, the less we ask of, you know, the world, the less we ask of our government, the more we take our lives into our own hands. And then the more we're free to live as we'd like to live. And
I think
is pretty, yeah.
I think that's totally true. I completely agree.
Yeah, permaculture would be pretty much impossible to really regulate, is the way I look at it right now. To where it's all depending on the location of you're at. And so you need more of consultants than anything.
And it probably
best utilize that area.
It's probably beneficial to be in, you know, if you're going to utilize permaculture, to be in more warmer climates, moist, warm climates, right?
It really can be done anywhere. But, I mean, you can design around all these aspects to help. You know, you can, just by how you design it, if you're in a colder climate, you could make it just with the design of trees and shrubs and ponds and buildings, of creating little warm bubbles. You know how a city has a bubble that creates a heat zone around it? You can essentially do the same thing in a localized setting, to where you can help protect plants from frost. And, you know, if you get an early frost, that your design helps prevent that area of your land from freezing or getting a frost that night. And, I mean, you're always going to have to deal with wintertime, but it's, if you live in a warmer climate, you can end up getting get three crop rotations in a year cycle. You know, in the northern Midwest like us, it's, you know, you usually get one or two max. You know, more of the seasonal. You know, you might get a summer crop and a fall crop. That would be my two crop rotations that I would consider.
So it's less it's less reasonable in a winter climate. It's doable, you're saying, but then it involves a lot more storing of food for the winter, canning, things of that nature. But, I mean, the one thing that we can say is that we know it's possible because we survived. I mean, human beings have been around for a long time. I mean, we haven't always had refrigerators and railroads and airplanes with which to transport food, and we haven't had the mass production of food for thousands of years, you know. So we know that it's possible to survive in colder climates without the modern-day, you know, systems that we have. So we know it's possible, but, you know, nobody wants to go back to the Dark Ages. I mean, there was a period of time when people in colder climates essentially slept for, you know, the majority of the day throughout the winter just to survive so that they weren't using as much energy. We obviously don't want to go back to that. But there were techniques employed that help us survive the winter time.
And yeah, well, there's always a trade-off with the vicinity you live in. Usually colder climates, like us, have much more water to deal with. So it has, you have that much benefit of the water to where you're not facing a drought, possibly, on certain years, which you would design around anyways, create dams and create ponds to help preserve water through the low rain periods in more of hot climates. But, it's
paying attention to that local environment anyway. So, like, it's good that we're having the discussion of warm versus cold climates. Because the whole point is to look at your, you know, immediate environment and say what's going to work here. And that's why it's very decentralized, because what works for somebody in Arizona is not going to work for someone in Minnesota and vice versa. And that's what really pushes it to be more individualized, decentralized, and personal, which is really what allows it to be a bottom-up strategy instead of a top-down one.
Yeah, and to me that's essentially what all liberty aspects boil down to. As, you know, free to live as you want to, and so you, with the work you want to put into it, is that's the benefits you'll get from it. That,
should we play that last clip?
I'd like to hear it.
That would be the David Holmgren clip?
Yeah.
Sure, here it goes.
The other way to think about permaculture is as a way to change the world, because of course a lot of people are motivated around permaculture as a positive, we can change the world in a positive way, rather than just endlessly trying to stop the world we don't want. Permaculture has always been about how do we create the world we do want. Well, when you start to think about those issues, most people think about how we change public policies, how you get the leverages of power pulled in a different way, so all the big structures in society get changed. That's an old way of changing the world. The sort of new way that's now sort of well proven, but still a lot of the politicos, the people who think about how do we change the world, haven't caught on, that actually by changing yourself and what you do yourself, that is actually not just a little stepping stone to contributing to a larger change. It's actually arguably the most powerful thing you can do. And the some of the reasons why are, firstly, if you've got a strategy or anything in permaculture, from owner building to community-supported agriculture, right back to just growing your own food in your backyard, when you do something for yourself that you benefit from, that reflects the ethics and design principles of permaculture, you're doing something for yourself and you're also reducing your adverse impact on the world. But by doing something that you benefit from, that is potentially attractive to other people to say, oh, I'll do that too. Whereas the hard-bitten person who's doing something just to atone for our sins in the world is not very attractive to many other people. Mm. You know, a small proportion are motivated by such things. But most people want to get something out of it, and especially get something directly. So the permaculture strategies benefit the early adopters, and on top of that, they're simple, low-key things that other people can copy. And they often don't need permission of the authorities, of the banks, to provide funding to do it. And that's really important, because a lot of these changes, if they were done at even by a proportion of the population, represent a real threat to a lot of the power structures in society. A lot of those centralised systems, the corporations, the governments with their tax base. So they would understand that a lot of this self-reliant stuff associated with permaculture is actually subversive. And so if it really took off in a large way, it might be not just not assisted, but attempts to prevent it. If that's like some advanced technology or very large-scale project, it's very easy for power elites to say, no, can't do that. And we can see the struggles over renewable energy versus fossil fuels. But if it's something that you can do at home, it's very, very hard to stop it. So on top of that, that copying allows rapid evolution where you improve the thing, because you do one example and then you copy it and do another, and you get this incremental improvement. If we did big projects that are all driven by sustainability concepts but represent massive reallocation of society's resources, it always will end up as a mess. Because somehow the complexity of those things, you might have the ideas, but when you actually go to do it, it's never quite right. So the small-scale replication, rather than big, giant projects, is a good learning process. And it also allows people to adapt the solutions to different situations. And that's very, very important, because every situation is slightly different. And then when you get more people doing it, that gives you, if you like, the lobbying power of, well, there's all of us over here doing this. We've got a bit of a power base through autonomy, not a power base through shouting louder to get the authorities to change policies, because that's really a powerless way to go about things. And we can see in the last 30 years how mass movements to get structures to change direction, whether it's due to engaging in foreign wars or whether it's to do with climate change, have actually been harder and harder to get those changes and requiring more and more mass movement resources. Whereas when we just do something that supports ourselves and provides an example to others, it's actually also the leverage towards a larger positive change.
That's a pretty good clip.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I think it's just interesting. And like we talked about this when we were talking about, you know, how do we, you know, get rid of GMOs or different things like that, how we're seeing people, you know, voting with their dollar, or individuals, you know, making choices for their own lives that then turns into a much bigger movement and actually creates the change that we want to see in the world. And instead of, you know, coming from policies or from the governments or large organizations or huge projects, we're starting to see people enacting change just by making individual decisions about their own lives. And that's what I think is really powerful about this. And really, really a big difference from the way that we've traditionally seen changes being made, or the way that we think about trying to make changes in the world.
Yeah, I it's something that you can do to benefit yourself and also actually make money off it too, and benefit other people in your community, or sell locally to local restaurants or and such. You know, it's I think it would just be awesome to have a plot of land that you utilize permaculture methods, and then even have another greenhouse where you utilize aquaponics for, you know, during the winter times, or, you know, to grow plants that you can through aquaponics that you have all at hand then all year long, and then, you know, then you grow the plants that are seasonal in your farmlands and the other vicinities. But it's it's such an old concept in a way to think of farming and creating your own food that it's just so foreign to us these days.
it is how I look at that.
And but really, through technological methods and through things like the internet, like they're talking about, how it ties people together. You learn life lessons from what goes wrong in areas, what can work, what works best in certain vicinities. Say you move somewhere, and you can learn fairly quick through the internet and getting in contact with local people that
you can really problem solve by seeing what other people have done and where it's gone wrong and what's really worked well. And that tends to be the more natural way that people learn and systems evolve. And what's really been interesting, I know I mentioned to you guys at some point about this book by Daniel Quinn called Ishmael. There's something that's kind of unique about the current system that we live in, is that it defies the way that human beings have historically created and evolved societies. The way that this system was evolved, I shouldn't even say that it was evolved. That's the whole point. We just said, let's do this. Let's go in that direction. Let's, you know, have a huge manufacturing plant. Let's live in cities. When it hadn't been time-tested and true. And historically, you know, people saw what worked and what didn't and evolved systems over time. They took the knowledge, you know, from their elders, and then that was passed along from generation to generation. And they just tweaked the system, you know, as they saw something fail or wasn't working. They made it better and enhanced it over time. But keeping those traditional lessons and those time-tested and proven methods, they continue to employ those because they knew that they worked. And when you have something like permaculture where many people have these systems, it turns into more of an evolution of understanding what works, what doesn't, how can we make it better.
Yeah, We've had three podcasts in a row about agriculture. We started with farm subsidies and alcohol from agriculture, and then talked about GMOs, and both of those have their problems, and this permaculture aspect is kind of a solution that really ties into liberty. And I think that it's something that no one's really heard about. And that I hope we sparked interest. And if anyone's interested, I highly encourage people to go online and just type in permaculture, and you'll find plenty of YouTube clips or websites to get a ton of workshops, courses, and there's a lot of even free courses on YouTube that'll teach you permaculture. And it is a trade. Marked word to consider yourself a permaculturist, you need to get licensed or get a certificate for, since it's
but who needs the name? Screw that. That kind of defies the whole purpose of doing this, doesn't it? Get a license to be a
on. That is another topic.
I'd rather
but it does just show that you've taking the time to go through the whole process of the permaculture. That
walk up to your neighbor and go, look, I got a license. What about you?
I'm certified.
I'm certified. Yes.
to put it in your resume or a business card or something would be illegal if you did not have a certificate in it, since it's a trademark.
All right. Folks, we got to wrap this up. This has been Liberty Southwest podcast number 35. Today is December 1st, 2014. This has been Danny Ning, Kirk Pettis, Eric Taylor, Chelsea Como, Lydia Tabbitt, and Matt Winter. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
A wolfless episode.
Adios, mofo.